Good morning. During my junior and senior years in college, I led a high school youth group at my home church in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And on one of my summer breaks, I decided to take five boys on a backpacking trip to the beautiful Shenandoah National Park. The plan was to drive from Pennsylvania to my brother Bill's house in Virginia, and then he would drive us to the trailhead, and then we'd hike for 5 days, and he'd pick us up at the final destination. I figured that that trip would be a great way to build relationships, to get us out in God's beautiful country, and to talk about life and to talk about the gospel. I figured wrong. To start with, we had two flat tires on the way down. I had one spare, of course. When we finally did begin hiking, we realized quickly we were carrying way too much gear. We had canned goods, fresh fruit, and a big tent. The packs, if you've ever backpacked, you understand this, they began to rub our skin raw. Caused heated discussions among the boys as to who would carry what items. Everybody was arguing for ways to lighten their own load. Another problem, one of the boys who was not real emotionally stable to begin with lost it. The stress pushed him over the edge. He became contentious. He became paranoid that we were all out to get him. At several times, we'd be hiking along, and he would walk off the path into the woods alone. He'd say, "I don't need you guys." And I had to be like a psychiatrist just to woo him back to the group. It was so bad, I had to sleep with one eye open, fearing he'd do something to us in the middle of the night. Another problem. A couple days in, we decided to take a shortcut. That didn't work out either. We got lost. Dangerously lost in an ocean of trees. We wandered around for hours. We had no water. We were so parched. And then we saw a bear. There's a bear in that woods. Somehow we managed to find a stream. We just plunged our faces into it. We trudged on and found a clearing. I shut it down. I said, "No more walking. We're going to set up camp for the duration. Somehow get in touch with my brother. We're not moving." But it's not over. That afternoon, one of the boys, such a good boy, he said, "My ear hurts." If you ever had an earache, I have, you know that path of misery. Well, we had nothing in our first aid kit that would help, and it grew steadily worse. In the middle of the night in the tent, I was awakened by that boy. I can still see it now. He's on his hands or his elbows and his knees, rocking back and forth with his hand over his ear, moaning and crying. There were no cell phones. We were an hour's walk from the nearest road, and then the payphone was miles down that road. And his mom lived in Pennsylvania, which is 4 hours from our campsite. Somehow, we did it. We made the call, and the next day, his mom rolled up in her car and carted him away. That's an example of well-intentioned plans going terribly awry. In times like that, I said to myself, never again. Never again will I find myself in a tent with an aggressive boy on one side and a sick boy on the other, hours from a phone, in the woods, surrounded by bears. Not going to happen again. And I'm certain that all of you can relate to putting effort into things and having them go wrong. For instance, some of the younger guys and girls in this room have ventured into the dating scene. There's nothing better than having a girlfriend, you know, somebody that thinks you're cute, somebody to have lunch with at Mesquite Barbecue. I mean, it's good. But many times it just goes awry and somebody's heart is broken. And when that happens, you say, "I'm going to be a nun," or "I'm going to be a monk. I'm never going to do that again." Perhaps you try out for a sport, maybe basketball or volleyball, and you train hard, you work hard, you make the team, and a couple weeks in, you strain your Achilles tendon. You're on the bench. Or maybe you're into the season and someone a little bit better than you shows up and takes your spot. Some of the adults in this room have started businesses. You've done your research, you launched a plan, you got all the equipment, and you're up and running, starting to make a little money. And then in the middle of the night, somebody sneaks up and steals your tools. Or a competitor undercuts you, steals your clients. Parents, maybe you decided that having a dog would be a good idea for your little son. Teach him responsibility to feed him and walk him and to give him protection and a companion. It's a noble pursuit. So maybe you say, I'm going to get a cute pug. And you get that little pug and he fits in like an old shoe. And it's working out wonderfully. Then something happens to that little pug. We had friends down the street, dear friends. They've moved away. Matthew, 7 years old, had a dog named Cody. He talked to Cody like Cody was a person. When Matthew would watch TV, he'd rest his head on Cody's belly. They were inseparable. One day there was a tap at our front door, and I go to the front door, and Leslie was there, and Matthew's on the front porch. And he was silent. And finally, he mustered up the words, Cody got hit by a car. He turned around with tears, couldn't say another word. What are we supposed to do? No more dogs? Or how about something way more serious than dogs? How about marriage? Perhaps you've chosen that God-honoring path of marriage, and you've thrown yourself into that relationship with everything you've got, but as time rolls on, you find out your mate maybe is lazy or rude or distant or worse, unfaithful. Or maybe the love of your life gets ill and dies. That's indescribable heartache. I heard one girl who asked when she was just getting ready to marry, she said, how do I know that my husband will be faithful to me? You don't. There are no airtight guarantees. And that fact might make us reluctant to marry. Commendable, God-honoring ventures from dating to dogs, from sports to spouses can fall apart. Despite our very best efforts, there's no guarantee of success. How do we live in light of that sobering fact? How are we, as God's people, supposed to act in a world full of uncertainties? That question has been on people's minds for a long, long time because life has always been uncertain. And that's why King Solomon applies his wisdom to that subject in Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I'd like you to turn there with me and I'll read. You can follow along the screen or in your Bibles. We're going to be reading Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. Beginning in verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, and after many days you will find it again. Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are full of water, they pour forth rain on the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. In these verses, Solomon answers the question, how are we to live in a world full of uncertainty? And he gives us two answers to that question. How to act in a world where our best efforts don't always pan out. But he doesn't only answer the question, how. He answers another question that'll bubble up as we talk this through, and that's the question, why? He'll answer the question why we should take his advice, why we should do what he says. So we're going to camp out on the question how, and once we've nailed that down, we'll turn our attention to the question why. And all together, it'll give us some sound wisdom for navigating this world where things don't always go as planned. So how? How are we to live in a world of uncertainty? His first answer to that question may be unsettling to some of you here today. It's not the kind of things preachers usually talk about a lot. But if you've ever read Ecclesiastes, you know that this book is blunt. Solomon observes life and calls it like he sees it, with no spin. So here it is. Answer number one, how we live in a world full of uncertainty? We're to accept the fact that life is indeed uncertain. We need to accept that sobering fact. Our ventures may fail. There are no guarantees that our best laid plans or our hard work will play out like we hope them to. They would. For instance, if you go to college, there's no guarantee you'll graduate. Maybe you'll run out of money. Maybe there'll be a family crisis at home you need to leave. Or maybe the building will blow up. If you plant a garden, you work hard. There's no guarantee you'll ever eat anything from that garden. All it would take would be one Texas armadillo to go on a rampage, and that's it. If you change career paths, maybe you said, I can engage more in this career. I'm going to contribute to this company. You get there, get situated, and a new supervisor moves in, and that supervisor doesn't like you. Or the company downsizes. Out you go. Or the building gets eaten by termites or something. We just don't know. There are no guarantees in life. Life is uncertain. But don't take my word for it. Let's listen to God's. Let's see how Solomon explains this truth. In these verses, Solomon spotlights two of life's ventures. He shows us that neither of these ventures are guaranteed success. One venture's on the water, like doing business with ships on the sea. The other's on the land, farming. The venture on the sea is discussed in verse 1. He says, cast your bread upon the waters, and after many days, you'll find it. Perhaps a more helpful translation would be, send your grain across the seas, and in time, you'll get a return. Send your grain across the seas. Solomon, we know from 1 Kings 10, had a fleet of ships. And he would send those ships on three-year trading ventures. He'd load up his ships with things like grain and then send them across the seas. In time, those ships would return with, we read in 1 Kings, gold, silver, ivory, apes, and baboons. Go figure. But that's business on the sea. The business on the land, that's farming. And that's referred to in verse 4. Where it says, whoever watches the wind won't plant. Whoever looks at the clouds won't reap. Planting, reaping. Verse 6, sow your seed. That's farming. Those two noble ventures on the sea and on the land represent bookends for all of life's ventures. And somewhere between the sea and the land is your life and mine, our God-honoring pursuits, like backpacking or dating or marrying or going to school, like I mentioned. Solomon is saying that all of our ventures, every one of them, no matter how well we plan or execute, are subject to, verse 2, disaster. It says at the end of verse 2, for you do not know what disaster may come on the land. He's saying, ships sink, crops fail, and that's the way it is. In this phase of God's program, between the Garden of Eden and future paradise, disaster stalks our ventures. If you buy a house, the roof can blow off. the foundation can crack. If you pursue a friendship, it's a noble venture, and you come to love and depend on your friend, then your friend's transferred, moves away. Or you launch an exercise plan and you blow out your knee. This idea is spelled out in living color in some interesting verses in the chapter before. Chapter 10, verse 8 and 9 read, "Whoever digs a pit," talking about a guy digging a pit for water, to dig a well, "whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall," this guy's remodeling, "may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them." Solomon's saying that all of life's exploits have inherent risks. Don't be depressed by that fact. Don't be paralyzed by that fact. Don't be surprised by it. Just accept it. There are no guarantees in this life that our hard work will be rewarded. This idea is expanded in verse 3, where we read, "If the clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth." Good luck trying to stop the rain. If a cloud's full of water, it will open up, and we are powerless to prevent that. All we can do is grab an umbrella. In business, for instance, safety is number one. I ran a business, I have friends in business, and I'm working part-time at a business. Everyone, safety is the top dog. When I used to hire somebody to work in my lawn mowing business, the first thing I'd say is, "Don't get hurt." Then the next thing I'd say, "Learn to mow lawns well." And the third thing is, "Learn to mow lawns well really, really fast." Safety, quality, speed, in that order. But here's the reality. Regardless of the focus on safety, the number of meetings, the policies from OSHA, all the incentives, someone will cut their finger. Someone will topple off of scaffolding. Someone will run over somebody's toe with a forklift. In this fallen world, which God oversees, clouds fill with water and they pour forth rain. We can't prevent that. Parents struggle big time with that idea. I can't think of a more noble or God-honoring venture than raising godly children. And as parents, we try so hard to protect them. We want to keep them physically safe. So you put up a fence, and maybe you get that dog to protect them. You're talking about stranger danger. Talk to them about cars and crossing streets. We want to keep them healthy. So we feed them well. We take them to the doctor. We make sure they get plenty of rest. We want to keep them morally sound. So we teach them about the gospel, about Jesus. We cart them to church. But the reality is, much of our life is beyond our control. Just as we can't stop the rain, we can't fully protect our children. I think the only way to guarantee that our children will be protected is to not have children. And if you're not already too depressed, Solomon adds even more to this argument. Not only can we not prevent disaster from happening, verse 3b tells us that we can't change it once it does happen. We can't undo. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. All of us have things in our life that we would give our right arm to change. But this verse tells us once the tree falls, there it lies. There is a finality in many of life's events. I learned to drive when I was 16. I took driver's ed. I got my permit. I practiced with my dad. I got my license. I got my insurance. And then I promptly filled my car with my friends and had a wreck. I can still hear in my mind the screech of the tires as they tried to hang on to that road as I was going too fast around the curb. I can still see the car careen off the road, go through a telephone pole. I can hear the sick moan of the engine and the strange angle of the headlights as they shone into the grass and the dirt when the car came to a lurch. At that moment, I sat behind that wheel and I said to myself, no, this did not happen. I said, I'm dreaming. I'll wake up. But it wasn't a dream. It was a reality. I wrecked the car and there wasn't anything I could do to change that. Verse 5 sums this all up. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. We dwell in significant ignorance. We may understand it better by and by, as the song says, but we understand it rather poorly here and now. We don't know what's ahead. We can't prevent it. We can't change it. And when it happens, we might not even understand it. That's all God's domain. It's not ours. In the year 1819, the whaling vessel Essex was plying its trade. They had journeyed from the New England area, from an island called Nantucket, all the way down North America, all the way around South America, under the Cape, and they're now whaling in the South Pacific. The lookout in the crow's nest spotted a pod of whales and he yells, "There she blows!" And immediately the 20 men on deck sprang into action. From their 70-foot sailing whaling boat, they launched three small rowboats, six men in each one. Two of the sailors would stay on board to steer the mothership toward the hunt. The chase began. The men raced with all they had for those whales in their three rowboats. One of those three rowboats sprung a leak, was forced to return back to the mothership to do some hasty repairs so they could get back into the hunt. While those men were back on board, something strange happened. One of the guys spotted a huge male sperm whale, about 85 feet long. That's pushing the limits. And it was floating less than 100 yards away. So close, they said they could see its giant, blunt head etched with scars. And it was acting strangely. It was blowing and watching. And then it made its move. That whale put it into gear, and he began to pump his 20-foot-wide tail up and down. And as it picked up speed, water crested around its massive head. That whale rammed into the side of that ship. Bam! After that tremendous impact, the whale floated underneath the ship and just came up and bobbed hull to hull with the ship. It was stunned. It was unconscious from the blow. The men are just staring. And then that woozy whale woke up and he swam away. But he turned around. And this time he faced the ship head on. He snapped his jaws. He thrashed the water with his tails. And then he gave it all he had with twice its original speed. That whale charged that boat with his head halfway out of the water, a wide wake of white water beyond its tail. And the head of that whale struck the head of that ship with a tremendous blow. Wood cracked and splintered. But he wasn't done. He kept pumping that big tail up and in, and he drove that ship backward till the back end started to go a little underwater, and he kept at it, forced that ship under the sea. Within 10 minutes, the Essex was floating upside down in the South Pacific. Now, somehow in the mayhem, the men on board had managed to launch a boat, and there they sat, staring in disbelief. Eventually, the other two rowboats had cut loose from their whales because they saw the commotion. Just drifted up alongside, three rowboats. The men didn't say a word, just speechless. And finally, the captain, who was in one of the other rowboats, asked the question, "What happened?" The answer came in New England vernacular. "Captain, we've been stove by a whale. We've been stove by a whale." You and I live in a world where a single whale can sink a 285-ton vessel in 10 minutes and leave 20 men stranded in rowboats thousands of miles from safety. It can't be prevented, it can't be predicted, and it can't be changed once it happens. My friends, sometimes our most God-honoring, commendable endeavors will be stove by a whale. We live in an uncertain world. We need to accept that fact. Now, that may sound depressing, but in one sense, it's actually freeing. It means we can lighten up a bit when it comes to results. It means we could back off from blaming ourselves or blaming others. And it frees us from obsessing over, if only I had done this or that. The reality is, much of life is beyond our control. God is in control of the events of this world, not us. How are we to live in a world full of uncertainty? Answer number one, accept that fact. Life is indeed uncertain. But here comes a second answer. We might expect him to say, in light of the inherent risks in life, live cautiously. Be careful. Stay away from forests with bears. Think twice before you have children. Reconsider before you start a business. Maybe just pull in the reins on life. Don't take any unnecessary risks. Just kind of ease yourself out of bed in the morning and carefully drive to work. Keep a low profile. Slip on home. Put on your slippers, get on your couch, watch TV for about 50 years. Or better yet, just not get out of bed. But that's not what Solomon says. In fact, he says just the opposite. Instead of saying live cautiously, he says engage fully. Engage fully in productive activity. Fully realize that life's full of uncertainties and the results are out of our hands, Solomon says, fill our lives with productive, God-honoring ventures till the day we die. We're to invest our lives in meaningful activity despite the uncertainty, as long as God gives us breath. Don't let fear put you in handcuffs and shackles. If you've got something on your heart that's within your resources, go for it. Have more children. Foster children. Adopt a child. Go back to school. Say yes to ministry. Build a treehouse. I'm proud of our Centerpoint kids. Two of our girls are at Kansas Bible Camp right now serving. Two of our boys are serving at Hidden Acres. They're stepping up with no guarantee of success. Results are God's department. Engaging in productive activity, that's our department. Now let's look at the level at which we're to engage. He's saying engage, not in a half-hearted fashion. Verse 2 tells us we're to plan wisely, plan thoroughly. He says give portions to 7, yes to 8, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. Give portions to 7, to 8. Solomon wisely divided his assets among his many ships. 7, 8, 9, 10. That way, if one of those ships sank or a few of them got into trouble, he'd still get a return. That's good planning. And by the way, I think this is a good base, biblical basis for mutual funds. So you could use that. We can't control the outcome of our ventures, but we can plan wisely in light of those uncertainties. And I don't know about you, I rarely plan alone. Whether I'm remodeling a bathroom or strategizing for children's ministry, I always have advice. Always. It's Solomon who says in Ecclesiastes, two are better than one. But not only are we to plan thoroughly, we're also to avoid procrastination. Verse 4 says, whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. All the planning in the world doesn't amount to a hill of beans till we pull the trigger. Our tendency is to wait. We like to wait for the perfect time. But this verse tells us the perfect time never comes. The farmer who waits for the right wind patterns won't plant. The farmer who waits for no threat of rain, he won't harvest. His crops will rot in the field. The danger we face is that we will never sow nor reap while waiting for the ideal time to launch. Engineers call that paralysis by analysis. I call it talking it to death. What's on your heart? Family camping trip? Do you want to write a children's book? Do you want to learn how to play an instrument? Get to the mission field? Homeschool your kids? Stop waiting for the perfect time. It'll never come. Plan, launch, and verse 6 tells us we're to give it all we've got. Work hard. He says, sow your seed in the morning and at evening. Do not let your hands be idle. Those words, morning and evening, are used as figures of speech to communicate constant activity through the day. In chapter 9, verse 10, is one of my favorite verses that relates to this. Solomon says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. How are we to live in an uncertain world? We're to fully engage in productive activity. That might mean we need to try something new. Teach a class, mentor somebody, lead a small group, direct a kids club, or have a whole bunch of people over to your house for a picnic. Last week, I called one of our dear older women from our church family and asked if she would help out in our preschool Sunday school class. On the phone, she said, well, Steve, I have never done anything like that before. And there was a pause. And then she said, but I would love to. That's what I'm talking about. A refreshing sense of adventure. How are we to live in an uncertain world? We're to accept the fact that the world is indeed uncertain, and we're to engage fully in productive activity. But something's missing. If this was all Solomon gave us, I wouldn't be satisfied. For him to tell us that things may go poorly if you try something, and then for him to tell us, go out and try it anyway, kind of leaves a gap in my mind. I might say, why? It'd be like telling your son, there's a stray dog just wandered up on our front lawn. He may bite. I want you to go outside and play with that dog. Boy might wonder, why should I take the risk of getting bitten? In the same way, we ask the question, why should I try something that might not work out? Well, Solomon gives us the answer to that question. He gives us three answers, three reasons why. And the first reason is simple and direct. Why try? Because God tells us to. This is His word. God, who is fully aware of all of life's uncertainties, God who orchestrates and directs this whole world full of uncertainties, calls us to obey Him in this area. The first verse of this passage begins with the word cast. The last verse of this passage begins with the word sow. The words cast, sow, bracket this unit. They are the thrust of this passage. These words aren't like motions at a board meeting. I move that we cast and sow. You know, all right, we have a motion on the floor. Here, a second. Second it. Okay. All those in favor, in light of the uncertainties of life, you know, say yay. You know, we ought to cast and sow. Say aye. Aye. How many say nay? Nay. No. This isn't up for a vote.
God is telling us. He expects us to fill our lives with productive activity. That's the way it is. And that should be reason enough. But he gives us another reason. And the second reason is less direct. It's implicit, but it's huge. Reason number two that we should engage fully is because when we do, we imitate God and bring him glory. When we fully engage in life, we imitate God and bring him glory. Verse 5 reads, "You cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things." God is referred to as a worker and a maker. When we work, when we make, we're acting like him. We mirror God when we work, make, cast, sow, and that brings him glory. God looks at his children and he wants to see things in our lives that are just like him. Like a proud father watching his child follow in his footsteps. Our tendency as church people is to tend to think that glorifying God is limited to worshiping together on a Sunday morning, or to evangelizing, or to giving money, or to living moral lives. But there's another way to glorify him as well, and that's by imitating him. God is a worker and a maker. He created people in his image to be like him. God didn't create human beings to be idle. My dog is idle. God created human beings to be active, to cast, to sow, to work, to make, to build, create, study, write, teach, lead, and on it goes. Some people cast, some people sow, but all of God's people are to try new things, venture out, engage in productive God-honoring activity so that we imitate him and bring him glory. My son-in-law, Eric, has planted a garden this year. He researched it thoroughly, planned it all out. He got materials from Mesquite Composting Center. He ordered some funky organics online, and he has built himself a beautiful garden. In that garden, there are tomatoes. There are Roma tomatoes, and there's bigger guys, and the vines are full. There are green peppers, jalapeno peppers. There's kale, and then there's some strange vine I've never eaten. You're supposed to just pull it off and help yourself. And then there's corn, and the corn is 4.5 feet tall today. Eric is imitating God and bringing him glory. Let that soak in. Even if that garden were destroyed by a meteor, God would still be glorified by his efforts. Why should we try something that might not work out? Because God tells us to. Because we imitate him and bring him glory. But there's a third reason, and it is obvious. Why should we try something that might not work out? Because it might work out. Sometimes our efforts might just pay off, and they might even pay off better than we'd hoped for. Verse 1 says, "Cast your bread upon the waters." Why? "For after many days, you'll find it again." Our efforts may be rewarded in this life. Verse 6 says, "Sow your seed in the morning, and in evening, let not your hands be idle." Why? You don't know which will succeed, this or that, or whether both will do equally well. Maybe we will be successful in a whole bunch of ventures. He's saying not all ships sink. Not all crops fail. Many, many of life's grand ventures are huge successes, like Solomon's ship bringing in gold and baboons. 5 years ago, I called my big brother, Dave. Dave lives in Pennsylvania. He's 6 years older than me. I said, Dave, how do I become a good grandfather? He has grandchildren. He gave me advice. He gave me three words. He said, get a pool. He said, you get a pool and they'll always be there. You get a pool and you can hands-on wrestle and tickle and race and have a lot of fun. So I talked to the family. I enlisted the help of my three sons-in-law, and they got to work. They located on Craigslist a used above-ground pool way up in Sanger. It was 32 feet long and 18 feet wide. It's big. It's a big oval. I said, let's go for it. So I rented a U-Haul truck, and then I took my work truck and about five guys, and we went up to Sanger early in the morning. We worked all day long disassembling this guy's pool. He gave us everything, the chemicals, the floaties, the filter, everything. We stuffed it into the U-Haul and in my truck, made it back. I got home at dark. Then I realized that my shed, because of the size of the pool, had to be cut in half. Got a big old wooden shed that had to be cut in half. So that was a big project. We cut it in half to make room for the footprint of this pool. And then I had to go to the city and start pulling permits. Oh, my goodness. I had to get out maps of my neighborhood to make sure I wasn't infringing on the property lines or the city lines. I had to pull three different permits for electricity and then a safety thing and something else. Oh, my goodness. And then I had to get a hole dug because our ground was on an incline and we wanted to countersink the pool. And it was way beyond us. And so I found a guy that digs holes for pools, and he showed up at my house on a Saturday afternoon. We're talking. He said, for $800, I can dig you a hole that'll be level within an inch. I said, you got a deal. He said, I'll do it tomorrow. I said, oh, tomorrow. Whoa, I'm not sure I'm ready for that. And he said, tomorrow, I got the time. Okay, go ahead and do it tomorrow. So while I was at church, the guy came out with his bobcat and dug the big old hole. When I got home, there's a crater in my yard, but it's perfect. All the dirt's mountained up and the ground is perfect. We did it. But on Monday morning, I realized that I was supposed to have gotten a thing called a dig test before you dig a hole. Oh my goodness, what now? So the rules are no dig test, no swimming pool. So I called that number on the sign, get a dig test, someplace in Dallas. Some lady answers the phone and said, I need a dig test. Thinking about putting in a pool. She says, Mr. Bergstrom, I'll send out four utility men. You don't need to be there. They'll just show up. One from Atmos, Encore, TXU, and they'll come and put a sign in your yard. You're good to go. All right, good. And then she asked a question. She said, Mr. Bergstrom, when they show up, will they have some idea where you're putting the pool? Probably. Well, we managed to get all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, everything above board, and we labored for weeks. Every free minute, every family and friend that showed up, I put them to work. My father-in-law showed up, grab a saw. My brother-in-law, grab a tape measure. We worked on the electric. We worked on the deck. We worked on the landscaping. While all the permits were winding down, the time was ticking. In my 58 years, I've never been engage in a project of that magnitude. It's just big for me. To say that the pool project was Herculean for us was an understatement. But we did it. We did it. And just last week, I was reminded why. Why we put all that effort into that pool project. Our 8-year-old granddaughter, JC, came over to spend the night with Mama and Pop-Pop. We'd had a good time. We were curled up on the couch. It's about 8 o'clock at night. It had been a cool, kind of cloudy day, and we were winding things down. And she said, Papa, I'd like to go swimming. Well, I'll do anything for that girl. So, sure, put on my suit. I figured we'd be outside for about 20 minutes, and it was kind of cool out there, and then we'd be in and put her to bed. Well, we got outside and jumped in the pool, and we played Colored Eggs. It's a game we can play in the water. And then I put her on the raft and try to yank it around and get her to fall off. And then we had a ball about the size of a basketball, and I tucked it under her legs, and she tried to balance on the ball. I can still hear her laughing as she went under the water. And then we hit a beach ball back and forth and kept count. We made 38 times. That was our record. Then I turned the pool lights on because it was getting dark, and we watched the moon rise. We stood there. There it was through the trees, almost a full moon. Then the crickets began to chirp. She noticed that. And the frogs joined in. And then we saw some lightning bugs here and there. An hour and a half later, we climbed out of that pool. And I wrapped her up in a big towel, and I held her. I love you, Pop-Pop. I love you, JC. For that one evening only, the whole project was worth it. But there have been countless other moments in that pool down through the years with Cooper and Eli and Charlie and Timothy. Sometimes our efforts really do pay off. Don't let fear hold you back in life. Go for it. Go for it. Give it your best shot to the glory of God. And who knows? You might be wildly successful. What God-honoring venture is on your heart this morning? Let's pray. Lord, give us the courage to live in a manner that brings you honor and glory for your sake. Amen.